want to thank you all for piling into KGB, and which is an appropriate venue, I think, Mike. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you tonight the unbelievable Mike Nelson. And joined with him in this conversation this evening is Creative Time curator Nato Thompson and former Creative Time curator, but we still call him Creative Time curator, Peter Ehling. So enjoy, and thank you for coming.
I can't see most of you in the audience, but I'm just curious if people can raise their hands if they've seen the piece. Okay, so
pretty good.
Seen the piece. Because it seemed like we would start by talking about the piece a bit, in part because it allows us to talk about certain earlier pieces of Mike's that factor into this work. But I think some people might be interested to know how a project like this comes about. And that's something we should probably discuss during the... We'll do 15 minutes of Q&A at the end. And some of those kinds of details are best saved for that part. But I think it's valuable to hear a bit sort of how this started. And it started, I guess, in earnest really last April when you came over.
And yeah, I suppose it followed on from... I suppose you saw the Istanbul piece.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
It's just... It's one of those strange things, isn't it?
That's true. Well, we started talking, that's right, about in 2003, right?
Yeah,
but then it was hard to figure out how to start something.
Yeah, and then you came off the back of the Margate piece, I suppose.
That's right.
I made a piece on the south coast of England, which was a rebuilding of a sort of disused cannabis farm on the south of England, which was in a very curious position in Britain in terms of its... quite, even though it's quite close to London, it's quite isolated, probably 2 hours drive, and it was built into a big old derelict building, a sort of combination of several rooms which were kind of rebuilt into and rebuilt as a sort of fate found sort of space, which was part fate and part sort of like kind of urban archaeology in terms of rebuilding what potentially had been there, but you know, in a more sculptural sort of fashion. But it was also very little visited in a way. I mean, the visitors were, numbers were low because of where it was, but it was a huge work. But Peter got there, so that was kind of good.
But so that's different in a way. You wouldn't describe this work here as something that constructs rooms that... I mean, I think a lot of people who saw the piece felt like many of those rooms were actually potentially ones that existed natively within that building. But in talking to you about the piece when you were making it, that didn't seem to be part of how you were constructing it.
It's still, I mean, it's in that vein of work which started probably in Sydney in the 2002 biennial sort of where I rebuilt a flat one-story building in the kind of King's Cross area of Sydney into a disused reptile house, which was
like a pet store,
kind of like a kind of exotic pet store, but it was kind of quite full on. There was probably 15 different big vitrines, some 2-3 meters by a meter high, with the back feeding corridors and landscapes, etc. But it was the first work, I suppose, in this sense where it was like a fate space, and to some degree sort of that work in fact, that work was described by one critic in Australia as the most indulgent piece of the biennial.
Indulgent?
self-indulgent, sort of. Because ultimately, I think I found out from another artist, another Australian artist, who worked at the museum that was part of the biennial, he actually hadn't realised, the critic, that the piece had been built, but thought we'd just found it and opened it as a found space. So it was, I suppose that was the first excursion into taking a sort of like a derelict or disused building, as opposed to building one straight within a sort of gallery or museum context. So the ambiguity between what was built and what's been found was kind of heightened and sort of undermined the sort of viewer's, expectation or sort of like applauding the sort of obvious craft of sort of like something that had been obviously faked.
Right.
I guess that's kind of, in some ways I always used to say to Mike, if you build this piece too good, no one will know an art piece exists. And we were all talking about how, it's always a surprise to hear people's responses when they come out in terms of what they kind of knew to be the work versus what they didn't. But you're, you know, you just have mentioned many times you're kind of, there's conceits that you make in the work to make it that there is an artifice involved, that it's not completely.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, this goes back to sort of, you know, maybe almost 10 years to the first, you know, work that kind of utilized sort of faked spaces, kind of, and especially with those early works, kind of, you know, I talk about, well, in a sense, you know, those first early works were very much a very clear sort of like, I suppose, sort of trying to sort of make physical sort of like a literary sort of or narrative structure. So your physical space became like a narrative space. And ultimately, those early spaces, and even to some degree, the spaces you'll see in the Essex Street piece, you know, aren't utterly convincing. They aren't utterly real. So some areas of it are more real than others, but ultimately it's to do with a sort of a willingness of the viewer. It's almost like a sort of a pact, like when you read a book, you know, or you know, the first chapter you might decide to sort of go along with the narrative, to with the fiction, and sort of even though you exist in your armchair at home, you're transported somewhere else, and you kind of you work into that sort of structure. So ultimately, sort of like that was the very beginnings of that, which was very kind of clear. And they, I mean, those big sprawling early labyrinths came out of earlier works, probably 15 years ago, which were built as the very first one was a raft built in a like at the top floor of a warehouse in Liverpool, which was just a raft with a tent on top and a few boxes. It was very sort of simple, and it was the first work really, which was I described it as a prop from a non-existent film, where I'd make a narrative, which is very, as always, a script, a very sort of like simple script, which would make a reference to the site in which it was built, to the political situation of the time, then a fictional other. This piece was called Taylor, after Charlton Heston's character in Planet of the Apes, and sort of played along with a sort of like a parallel narrative to sort of the Haitian sort of like boat crisis, or raft crisis of the time. So I suppose that developed into the more set-like works, but they were not theatrical. Well, they're theatrical in a sense, but they were kind of also real, because they felt real and they're built real in a real way.
It seems like we could also, I mean, we're going to talk about not just the kind of conceptual motivation of the work, but also just in terms of the brass tacks building. One of the things that we watched in your process emerge really quickly was an incredible amount of work going in straight into the floor itself.
Yeah, that was quite a nasty task. But I mean, it's just the easiest way to build that sort of structure. You know, if you want to drop floors into a sort of a built structure, it's far more long-winded than sort of building a platform to build off. But and the material we used was just like, I mean, it was just firewood, really. It was just the worst floorboarding you'd ever seen. Sort of a, you know, it varied between sort of like a 7-inch to a sort of 11-inch sort of wide plank. There was the wear on it was sort of like incredibly varied. So it was like a jigsaw puzzle, trying to place it all back together again, where the wear sat naturally, sort of like in the width of the planks and the joints kind of sat together. Which was, and of course the floor in that place is all dipped in hollows for drainage between all the columns. So trying to sort of flatten out a floor like that is without building a huge kind of like, you know, heavy structure that then means you've got to lift the floor up with ramps and steps. And so it was a long-winded job.
We've talked about this somewhat at the time and during the process of building it, but I'm curious the degree to which your process, which is part and parcel in the space, actually constructing things and out rummaging in the world for material that actually informs the content of the work itself, and how you think about that. How much of that is really an iterative process where, how much do you know at the beginning, and how much in this case changed in the course of it?
I think I always know far more than I believe I do at the beginning, because ultimately, sort of like, I would say like that early piece, the coral reef, sort of, if I read the press release which I wrote, sort of, which was the proposal for the work.
The coral reef was 2000, right?
Not built in 99, but opened
right
in 2000, sort of. and the press release is exactly what it is. I mean, in a sense, you know, the actual specifics in terms of sort of like the details, you know, you can't say that, you know, I'm going to put this. Well, you could, but I mean, it depends how much money you've got. I mean, obviously, everything is possible that you could just. But ultimately, sort of, you know, you come into a project like this, and you have to hunt for things that which somehow might articulate what you're. I mean, I suppose ultimately, you know, when I left college, I was making much more kind of dry, sort of didactic work, you know, which had a sort of a much clearer sort of political lineage, which. To make sense of, you had to sort of like follow that lineage and make one step to another step to another step to make sense of it. And I somehow, at the same time as making that RAF piece, I was making other works which were more like this. I remember opening a show in a transmission gallery in Glasgow, the, you know, a month or so before, which I was quite pleased. You know, it was one of those pat yourself on the back. It's kind of quite clever structurally, sort of like conceptual work, sort of. But noticed that sort of like actually nobody was really paying much interest to it, in a sense. You know, they weren't making those leaps of, you know, connection that I kind of wanted them to. And, you know, obviously a critic might do, but I didn't find the public were engaged in the same way that the more sort of. Richer, more narrative works were, and ultimately, sort of like what those works did was to create spaces somehow for other people's imagination, sort of like ultimately, sort of which I think I found that you could somehow articulate certain ideas, sort of like certain sort of like. Senses, I suppose, sort of like, you know, you could manipulate people's empathy somehow for certain causes or territories, sort of like through constructing things which allowed them to sort of like not be forced into a certain headspace somehow, but just sort of ease them in.
But with a piece like this, where you, you know, the majority of your audience is a New York audience and an American audience, how do you, as an artist who's so astute at sort of trying to figure out how those spaces exist and how to construct them in a way that allows people into them and allows the audience to create that sort of experience for themselves. How much does the challenge of knowing that audience impact a work like this? Or not knowing it, I suppose.
I don't know. It's not. I haven't found audiences on this level a whole lot different ultimately. I mean, if somebody comes with a certain agenda, which obviously, you know, they're probably more likely to have in a big city like New York with a big art scene, you know, there might be more problematics, but ultimately sort of I've found you know, from the general public who aren't biased against art up to people kind of like involved, more involved in art, they tend to be quite well, kind of enjoyed ultimately. I think sometimes there's a problem if, because there's several different genres, I suppose, of work that I've done, sort of like over the years. I mean, the 90s was much more kind of sculptural, much more sort of playful. There was like a fictional biker gang called the Amnesiacs that made much more sort of like abject, sort of like, you know, installations and sculpture, you know, through. You know, the labyrinth works of the sort of early 2000s or mid 2000s, of the rebuilding of you know, faked found spaces and the darkroom pieces as well, which I've been doing. So I can't remember where I was going there, to be quite honest. I've lost it.
Well, I think a lot of people asked me on Saturday if they saw the piece. It wasn't immediately evident to them what the connection between the various sort of vernacular religious shrine type situations you were creating, and then the conflation with American politics, in particular of the 60s and 70s with the Kennedy references and things like this. Although once they sort of got talking about it and I said, well, what did it feel like to you? They said, well, there's a way that conspiracy theories feel to me like part and parcel of that same sort of vernacular religion or something that drives the other. And I don't know if that functioned that way for you in the piece, but it occurred to me to ask.
Well, I suppose it's probably a time to go back to the actual structure of the work itself, and that the very in a sense, that first section after you've passed through the Chinese restaurant and then into this sort of series of sort of like slightly sort of absent collection of sort of receptions to two parlors and sort of like psychics or sort of like sort of slightly kind of condolable or kind of spaces. That section was very much a conscious sort of reworking of the structure of a work from 2000 from the Coral Reef. The Coral Reef was the first work ultimately which was like a full sort of like labyrinthine work which articulated sort of like narrative sort of space into sort of found space. And the Coral Reef ultimately was a series of receptions based on like London minicab companies, which if you look at any of those spaces, the people that inhabit them in a very sort of sparse way sort of like place their identity through few objects. So this came out of an interesting sort of like a literary structure of, say, writers like Stanislaw Lem and Borges, who would write sort of like books of introductions to non-existent books, where the first chapter would be an introduction to itself. It would argue it's just part of the anthology of short stories.
Right.
So in the Coral Reef, the first reception, I rebuilt the fake reception of the gallery itself, and then it led through to the back of a reception to an Islamic sort of minicab office, and then you ran through to sort of like a sort of a biker's sort of like hangout, to a sort of stoner's hangout, to a heroin user, to evangelical Christianity, to Mexican sort of Marxist. So in a sense, sort of like each kind of like reception was used as a vessel, you know, to represent a different belief structure.
Right.
And in a sense, I remember in the press release it was written that it invited you to be become lost in the world of lost people, in a sense that existed in the sort of substructure of society. If you imagine the reef as being a complex and fragile system, and the prevalent sort of ideology that existed above it, the ocean surface would be sort of like an economic structure of kind of capitalism. I mean, for me, it's the most pivotal work I made. Ultimately, kind of it was very sort of prescient, I suppose, in when it was made and the events that happened in the sort of subsequent sort of years afterwards.
Right.
In terms of sort of
September 11th.
Yeah, these
Afghanistan wars.
Yeah, these belief structures sort of like actually gaining more of a hold somehow. So, on coming across the Atlantic at this point in time, it felt like perhaps an interesting sort of thing to do, to revisit the Coral Reef, but sort of like revisit it where the sort of the ocean surface becomes not a metaphorical sort of like sea, ocean, but like a literal sort of like sea of sand with all the connotations that sort of like sand and it's sort of like a visibility sort of like has at the moment, and to build underneath something which seemed very much in a way that sort of like the minicab offices sort of like inspired or informed sort of like the Coral Reef, the psychic sort of booths, the sort of like the sort of voodoo and sort of condobla sort of like shops, the tattoo parlors somehow are somehow very present in the city, sort of like, you know, more present than any other city I've been in, somehow, you know, outside of the third world at any rate. And ultimately, for an artist that somehow has made their majority of work about the presence of absence, that sort of sense of absence within the city, or the presence of absence and the object, the obvious kind of absence.
You mean like Ground Zero?
Yeah, the obvious absence of sort of like the skyline of this city. Somehow seemed like an answer, this sort of like a desire for belief somehow in sort of like spurious kind of like religious sort of structures which outside of the mainstream of sort of like Christianity and or Islam or Buddhism.
Right.
it's interesting, too, to just, I mean, in terms of maybe you could just tell us, because you've got such good anecdotes about your own personal experiences in the United States, maybe you could just even tell you about your, what happened off the plane when...
Now that was, the first time I came here, sort of, I came off the plane sort of in, and headed into the sort of like immigration, and they put you in all, obviously, you put you in a different... queues, but they put me in like the because there's no Americans, they put me in the Americans queue. So I kind of stood there, and there was a couple of like Hispanic guys kind of going through before me, which took some time. And as I stood there, the queue kind of grew with a few other people. And when it came to my turn, I stepped up, and the guy in front didn't even look me in the eye, just leant over the counter and said, "Is there any Americans here?" Sort of like, he said, "Yeah, I am." So he came past, so I kind of went back. And this happened about four times, the guy never looking me in the eye, never addressing me, sort of like, and in the end, sort of like, you know, a whole plane offloaded. So there's about, well, a small plane, there's about 30 people queued up, you know, obviously all Americans. So I'm sort of like, I said to the person who put me in the queue, you know, what am I meant to do here? Sort of like, because by this point another huge plane had offloaded in the non-American queue, and it was like about a 3-hour line, sort of and said I don't know, it's not my, you know, I don't care. So I just I thought, well, I better go to the back of the big queue. And I thought, fuck that, I'll go to the back of the Americans where there's only about 30 people. So I stood at the back, and finally it went down. I was kind of praying that another American plane wasn't going to, sort of like a domestic plane, wasn't going to offload. And I finally got to the front of the queue again, and the guy kind of goes, "Oh, it's you again, is it?" And I sort of like, and he finally looked me in the eye and said, "You've got to remember that Americans always come first." And I was like, I had to really button my lip. It was like, Christ.
He said, "Now go make an artwork."
Yeah, like, yeah. But, yeah, it's been a curious experience. I mean, the most curious thing which you might have read in the paper was that, yeah, the inaccessibility of sort of salvage in this city, which kind of which was kind of surprising, being as probably the biggest city full of the most junk I've ever seen. So it was a curious experience.
But it's also, I mean, just to talk about this kind of, I mean, you'd mentioned the Joseph Beuys piece, "I Like America, America Likes Me,"
right,
as a kind of influence of Joseph Beuys when he came to the United States, but also historically, like Alexis de Tocqueville did the kind of study of American democracy, looking at the American prison system. There's a massive history of this, but this is your first New York exhibition, which for many people is quite surprising, considering how long you've been making work, and New York often considered a fairly major part of that network. So it's a long time coming. So I think you've kind of, in terms of doing this piece, you are kind of, you've obviously made a real statement about this country and its historical context. And I don't think I'm out on a limb when I say the piece is fairly dark.
Yeah, it's a dark time.
Yeah, very much so. Do you want to expand on that, or any kind of thoughts in terms of how you've kind of laid that out?
Well, I think, I mean, it's, I suppose always I go back. I mean, this is in the actual sort of process of sort of like the making of the work, I constantly go back, revisit sort of like territory, but also sort of in terms of ideas. And I go back to, say, the bus piece, which was the first major work I made in America, or the only other major work in America, in San Francisco in 2003. That work was very much interested in sort of like visiting that sort of Anglo-American narrative of the Gothic, somehow that sort of like lineage that sort of flows through from Poe to Lovecraft to Stephen King, sort of and with its kind of political sort of like sort of pillion rider, somehow, of sort of the witch trials through sort of the McCarthy era to sort of like the kind of Islamophobia, I think they coin it as these days, kind of this period. So, in a sense, sort of like, I suppose that darkness, that sort of a kind of return to sort of like a certain primitivism, somehow, and this kind of like desire to sort of like find some sort of handle on belief, sort of like in the face of such absolute belief elsewhere in the world, sort of seemed like the way to articulate a work in New York at this point in time.
And I guess that's kind of how, there's all these patriotic references. There's one particular reference that's nice to talk about, too. It's the American flag that's torn in half, that's in this kind of waiting room. It's also on the flyer for the exhibition.
The map, you mean?
The map, yeah, the map. Do you want to talk about that, where you found that?
Well, that's just, when we first looked at this building to do the work in it, there's an incredible upstairs to the building, which is not huge, but it's just a very disparate and, desperate sort of like a found space, you know, which has a collection of sort of all sorts of kind of memorabilia from stuff from the old Chinese restaurant to sort of bits of sordid looking underwear, sort of like
and duck sauce
and duck sauce, yeah, sort of and a series of sort of small booth like rooms which, you know, were obviously used for some sort of like a nefarious sort of like goings on, whether sort of in terms of, you know, the movement of people around a city, sort of like from another country or other such things. Kind of, but upstairs was this map, sort of just as it is built into one of the rooms in the middle, in the labyrinth of rooms in the first section, sort of. And that map just was as it existed somehow, and it just seemed very poignant somehow, sort of like as it ripped down through, you know, Louisiana, sort of like to the point of New Orleans, it seemed, sort of a bleak and slightly apocalyptic sort of way of a country divided.
And does that then sort of inform you when you go out and you're looking at flea markets and... And salvage yards. I mean, do you see something and you already sort of have a filter active that's drawing you towards particular things and tossing out other things?
Again, you go back to when you're at college. I mean, I went through college in the 80s where, you know, I remember the word intuitive was sort of like, if anybody muttered it, you'd be sort of laughed or beaten out, in fact, sort of like beaten out of you, sort of like, which, you know, for good reason as well, you know, in many senses, sort of like. But ultimately, I suppose, in terms of the structure of working now, I have a certain, like, a sense. Go back to Lovecraft. I mean, like when in his writing on, you know, the supernatural and literature, he talks about a non-linear narrative and just the idea of an assemblage of sort of atmospheres that sort of somehow cobbled together to give us some sense of meaning of feeling somehow, which I think I feel quite akin to somehow. But in that sense, you kind of start off with a sense, always like a something you want to sort of like convey, but, you know, of course you don't have all the materials, you don't have I have a floor plan obviously I'm going to build, but in terms of every object and how it all gets articulated, that's kind of quite a, you know, it's like an when you're working on something so intensely for 3 months like this and you've been thinking about it for 6 months before or a year before on and off, sort of like the final night, as you're vouch for, sort of like you're pretty sort of focused in terms of, like, you know, what you're trying to sort of articulate. So there is a certain instinctiveness sort of like by that point, which is very much informed by the research and the thinking, the kind of constant sort of like the process, I suppose. So in terms of like the objects within the market or the salvage yard, you know what you have a certain sense of what you're looking for, you know. And
there's certain stock things that sort of feel like, you know, TVs and the like that just sort of are going to function in some way in the work, I suppose. And then there's another level of things that are kind of elusively about different things that you're possibly thinking about, which don't, like, there's all these stacks of like Kachina dolls and sort of other, there's a whole element of Native American ephemera that was in the sort of storage room of material you'd collected, which made almost zero appearance in the work. Yeah, and yet nevertheless had a complete consistency in sort of looking at that room that the public never saw, that across all of this material that you'd amassed, you could sort of understand where the piece was going.
Yeah, I mean, I always amass far more than I ever use. You know, it's like an editing process then, sort of like in terms of both meaning but also formality ultimately. You know, because you have to remember that it's ultimately it's kind of sculptural. It is like a space which you enter and you pass through, and those formalities sort of like what ultimately kind of convinces you to believe in what is actually there. I mean, it's like It's
but it's funny because these pieces, I was talking to someone today who said to me, you know what, Mike's work is so classically English. And I said, really? No, I mean, maybe I don't know what classically English means. I said, no, it's all about landscape. And I said, really? To me, it looks like it's all about sculpture. I said, no, it's about landscape painting. It's about sort of what makes it into the picture and what doesn't.
Right.
Something which I hadn't thought about. But
people are amazing at using that word landscape.
I mean, it's true. Of course, there is a landscape element to these things. But actually having sort of been with you during periods when you're finishing rooms, they're much more of these sort of finely tuned instruments in a different way.
Yeah, the landscape thing is obviously, in terms of like, there's a sand and the Smithson piece that I made in Oxford. I mean, there's a landscape element there, but it's I can't quite see that. I mean, in terms of there is a formality to it, I would say, which I think a lot of people maybe miss. But
maybe we could just talk briefly also about the mechanics of disorientation, because sometimes I think, you know, when I was watching you work, I kept thinking, you know, this is, not to be corny, but it's almost, I know that Mike's got these Harry Houdini-like tricks up his sleeve, and he will deploy them at some point, and I want to be there when he does that. Because there are, you know, it's as big as the place is, it's not that big enough to get people as disoriented
as you
manage to do so fast. And, there's a few things you use in this show that I think are, you know, quite impressive, and there wasn't a lot of space to do it in. That's that double blind where you mimicked the waiting room in the beginning and then repeated at the end.
Yeah, that's a trick that I haven't done for a long time, but that's from a coral reef again. But it's always, in terms of replication, it's a kind of nice one because, you know, in terms of like, I don't know, if you think about like, in that sort of sense of, you know, once you find yourself in there, then you become disorientated and lost again. That sort of potential that sort of every other room has been doubled and each other room you're going into is kind of like being replicated again.
Right.
It's kind of nice. I mean, it's... there's always a moment in these shows, sort of like when I'm building them in these more found space, you know, labyrinth works, when a fly comes in. There's always the first fly. When you've got the plasterboard in and a few lights and like, and it kind of, and you see it articulate itself around the sort of space. And there's something.
But before the bones are there.
Yeah, before anything else. But it's something quite odd that this creature kind of like, there's something quite odd about sort of like the sense of reality of this fly in terms of the actual sort of like structure around it. And I suppose that's the same trick that's sort of like doubled again and again in terms of sort of like going to the Chinese restaurant, which is and then going into the other spaces and, you know, trying to work out, you know, what's real, I suppose, and what's not. And that sort of questioning of reality in terms of, you know, I suppose science fiction writers, if you think of kind of Philip K. Dick, empathy test for the sort of like I always think that's a good example.
But it's funny because I mean we don't tell anyone really anything about the work on the way in, and we sort of have, there are some people throughout who are volunteers sort of staffing it, and they're instructed not to tell anyone anything about sort of what's real and what's not. But the interesting thing is many people that I talked to who'd got to the end then sort of were interested to know that much of it was actually constructed and fake, because then they wanted to go back and try and figure out which parts were real and which weren't. And I think even the people who didn't sort of catch on to that at the beginning, there's still an element in each room that is patently new. Like in the bar, just the molding along the front of the bar is just out of whack with the used aesthetic of everything else in that room. And that gives you a hint and a way into the fact that there's something amiss and taints in each room. Even as you get used to it, there's something different. And if people look closely at the walls are completely new.
But I think that's what makes it different from, you know, a real space. And that's what's actually quite more interesting for me about it, because there's this space between sort of like kind of reality and that replication. And there's a sort of when you talk about the formality, the manneredness, like the bare skin, in the corridor, which somehow immediately makes that corridor sort of like has a kind of oddness, sort of like which
it's no longer a passageway either.
Yeah, it's kind of and in terms of, I mean, the fact it is a bear skin, that it is like a skin of an animal somehow, sort of like it's mimicking what it once was somehow. It somehow mimics the whole structure in itself somehow,
right?
In a sense.
It's interesting. I was just thinking, it reminds me so much of that new David Lynch film, Inland Empire, because there's all these scenes. A, it's where the actors forget, they can't tell when they're in the film or not.
Right.
But it's also a very dreamlike space where he'll often cast people that look alike, and you confuse which one is which. And dreams are very much about these, you know, it feels very dreamlike. I mean, corridors, doors, opening, getting lost, places repeating themselves. It really is like entering into a very dreamlike space. And
I think that's when it's successful, it is. It's, and I think it kind of works for some people, doesn't for others. And it's very sort of like dependent as well on when you'd visit it and how many people are there, sort of like, I mean, I think...
How many people would you prefer to be there at any one time?
Maybe two or three. I think by yourself it's very strange. I mean, I've been in there this afternoon taking pictures and it was kind of quite strange. Because you're constantly, like, cause the way it creaks, and when you open one door, it opens another somewhere else. I was kind of half aware that there was somebody else in there, but of course there wasn't. But just the way it was seemed to be sort of creaking.
And there's so many ambient noises that people don't hear.
That's right. And the click of the fan.
The click of the fan. And
I mean, for ages when I was there by myself, I thought somebody
was hammering.
Like, I thought, who the hell is still here hammering somewhere? Or like, I thought the guy in the diner was sort of doing something kind of.
Right.
But then in the end, you can locate it. And it was just a tiny click of the fan. And it sounded like a sort of incredible somebody beating a wall, a masonry wall, some way away.
Right.
Which is nice, but you don't get when you're in there with 70 people or something.
That's true.
So, and it becomes far more kind of carnivalesque in a sort of in a less effective way. Sort of, I think when there's too many people. But this is the problem I had in the last Turner Prize. I built a piece like a warehouse, disused warehouse to store an old work in, and that was somehow undermined by its. By the amount of people somehow passing through constantly.
Right. Well, they're like all the rest of the material. And if there's too much in one room, it destroys the whole thing.
Yeah,
I think if people have questions, now's probably a good time. Okay.
I can run. You know what? I'll do this Phil Donahue thing.
This relates just what we talked about. So do you also ever try to disguise, the institution at all? So that it just would be a warehouse and people would discover it on their own terms? Not just to get rid of all the people, but also get rid of the art context? Or is that...
Well, as I said, the piece in Istanbul, I mean, it was part of the biennial, but all they had was an address in... this hand, like a caravanserai that sort of in the sort of Eminönü, the shopping territory of sort of like Istanbul, it's at the foot of the sort of Grand Bazaar and the Süleymaniye Mosque. So it's incredibly convoluted, the streets there, and confusing. It's incredibly hard to find. There's probably about 10 different hands in the different territories. So to actually find it was very difficult. I mean, it took me a long time to find the space to actually make the work in it, let alone anybody else. And I had friends who went and said, well, I couldn't get in. I mean, I found door 51, but it was like, there was nobody there. But then when they described it, I knew which hand they were in. They were in a completely different one. But this was, I mean, with that work, I was very conscious of sort of like building in that confusion as to the actual work. I mean, it was built in the biennial, and the biennial was predominantly in these big white spaces in the harbour area, and the harbour area was not even sort of you know, Turkish territory. It's like no man's territory. It's a harbour. So somehow to try and sort of like lure the sort of like the art crowd out of there, sort of like, and perhaps for them to get lost in this city. And even if they didn't find it, somehow it seemed to function as a work in itself. I mean, what they found then was a dark room where I documented the whole building. So in a sense, the building had sort of documented itself in a dark room, which emulated the style of the rest of the workshops and sort of industrial estate that were there. So that work, and also the Sydney Biennial work, was just that was very ambiguous as to what it was. And there was no signage; it was just a number. And there was just a sort of like a close circuit television and a buzzer to let you in. So there was, I suppose, those works. And then on a sort of contrary sort of level, the ICA in London. We kind of rebuilt. Me and the team sort of rebuilt the whole place as a sort of like a found space. Ultimately, sort of which was successful to a certain degree. It was an awkward work actually. That was, but it kind of it succeeded on some levels.
What do you consider the relationship between your work and like performance art or performance? Because I found when I was going through the installation, part of the theatricality that you talked about was from the objects, but another interesting part of it was from the people and the contact that you had with, you know, I was with two young teens, or I don't know, young people in that doubled room, and I knew it was doubled, but they didn't, and they were trying to get out, and you know. The audience was a big part of the experience for me. I'm just curious about your thoughts on your work as performer.
Well, I think there's a strong performative element in it, which, but I actually hate anything performative from that I have to do. I don't like doing at all. I avoid talks like the plague. So kind of a, but ultimately sort of you know, it is like some very sort of like, because you know, the. That sense of people, somebody has having spent time in a space, or a space feeling like it's been occupied, or sort of like tended to over a certain period. It's quite a hard thing to do, but without that performative sort of like element. And that, and when you talk about process, I mean, maybe process could almost be sort of like a exchange for sort of like performative, almost sort of a, because. You know, that period of time spent sort of like looking and searching for sort of like objects, etc., is quite performative. You know, even in the relationships you sort of like spring up with, you know, people in the different markets or salvage yards or whatever. And on a very obvious level, yeah, I suppose kind of like I'm forcing the viewer into a more performative role, sort of like in terms of their kind of relationship with space and other people and articulating around them.
All right, Kara, coming in.
Could you tell us about your choice for the title, A Psychic Vacuum?
Psychic Vacuum goes back to... in a way, I've got a debt to sort of like Stanislav Lem in that title, in that the work that the Coral Reef was ultimately based on was the work of literature was a book called A Perfect Vacuum, which was a series of reviews of non-existent books, and it's remained one of my favourite sort of like pieces of writing sort of ever since. So a psychic vacuum is a sort of derivation of that title, ultimately, sort of. But I like the idea of a vacuum, the idea of sort of that sense of the. Somehow it seemed to. It's a sort of title or a statement which somehow makes no sense and absolute sense at the same time and describes that sense of sort of the, I suppose, presence of absence somehow, which I was talking about earlier on. And has obvious connotations in terms of the kind of like the contents of the rooms inside.
Question over here. You have a lot of old objects that you populate.
your work with. And the scenes that, when you're walking through them, the scenes are pretty dark. They're really funky and very dark. And I'm wondering if when you're working on it, or if you spend too much time there, if it ever overwhelms you and kind of fills you with dread, maybe to go back.
Not really, because I kind of like the spaces. That's the sort of like the sad thing. I feel rather at home. Other people might find it quite dark, but I find it quite uplifting in a sense.
What's your house like?
It used to look like that, but not anymore. I moved house, and that's when actually when I did the Oxford show, I kind of rebuilt my studio that I'd worked in for. Well, it was only a room of a front room of a Victorian terrace. But it was my studio for years. It was just like full of, like one of those rooms, but solid, full of stuff. I rebuilt that for the Oxford show with a sort of a bounce back, sort of like a video projection of a sort of like conspiracy theorist giving a slide talk, which fed into the sort of Smithson sort of like a Palenque sort of like a narrative that was running through that work. But I remember, like, because that street became very gentrified, and I'm sure they thought this, I was some sort of ritual abuser, sort of like a. Until they saw me in the paper and they realized that I was far more harmless than that.
How much physical labor do you put into the work, and what part does it play in its construction for you?
Do you work hard?
I don't know. Ask the man at the front. I could do quite a lot of work. Yeah, I do a lot of the building, and it is an interesting question, because it is slightly perverse that I do so much of the labour as well. Sort of like, but in terms of in what you say about the process, it is a sort of like a way of kind of entering into a sort of. Commitment and mindset, ultimately, sort of in terms of the work, and ultimately, sort of like what would seem to many people as being very sort of slight decisions in terms of like changing the height of a ceiling, or sort of the positioning of a door, or sort of the type of trim, sort of like, or finish along the kind of like the baseline of a wall. I find incredibly important, ultimately, sort of. So I find it kind of essential that I build it, you know, with whoever I'm building it with, sort of like, so that those decisions can always be made. Otherwise, it's I'd just be on the phone all day. Yeah. But
I'll go to the back here. I'm coming to you.
Why don't you just yell it out?
Yeah.
Not really, no. I would say that sort of like there is an incredible prevalence of tattoo parlors and psychic booths sort of like in the Lower East Side, but I mean ultimately it spreads all through Manhattan and into Brooklyn and whatever. It's more a work that's made sort of like about a certain sense within a certain city at a certain point in time. There's nothing outside of the sort of formality of the sort of working of the sort of spaces and with the materials and with the sort of like the way the space existed, that in terms of like a sort of historical sort of like referencing of sort of like that specific history.
Early on, when you spoke about the surface of the ocean and the coral reef underneath and so on, you mentioned briefly its connection or analogy to capitalism. Maybe I misunderstood. Could you elaborate a bit more?
Well, the coral reef was, I suppose, a metaphorical sort of title for sort of a structure of the underbelly of society somehow, as I saw it within London at that point in time, utilising the sort of minicab offices as a vessel to sort of like, because ultimately those minicab offices were sort of like the spaces in which the guest workers, the sort of like the illegal immigrants, the sort of like the kind of the lower echelons of sort of society, the ex-cons, kind of like would sort of like be working somehow, because you know the minicab offices in London are outside of the main taxi companies. They're not, well, until recently they weren't really registered or kind of like monitored. So they always were like a frontage, you know. I worked as a builder years ago, sort of like in the East End of London. I remember ripping down a building next to a minicab office, sort of like, you know, the toilet, unfortunately, their toilet next door fell into our foundation course, sort of, and from the back of the toilet, like, loads of credit cards and checkbooks kind of came out. They obviously kept all their, sort of, like, they're a real rough bunch, sort of, like, so we had to build their toilet again, sort of, so in a sense, it was always like a frontage, like, a sort of, like, for something else, somehow. These, you know, there was always something else going on behind, and that sort of sense of I suppose belief systems sort of you know, using them as a vessel somehow to articulate or kind of like give voice or kind of visibility to those different belief structures which are struggling to get a hold, you know, in the face of sort of like such kind of such impossible sort of like, you know, economic power of sort of capitalism somehow. I mean, we're talking 1999, really, this is being made. So, you know, the whole sort of like, you know, Al-Qaeda sort of, you know, war against terrorism thing really isn't really an issue sort of at this point. So, in a sense, you know, for me, it was a very prescient work sort of like in terms of its talking about that. And I suppose when I was talking about the coral reef, you know, the ocean surface under which kind of like, because, you know, obviously with the undulating low ceilings of all the different rooms, sort of like it gave us a dreamlike sensation of being under an ocean surface, sort of, and that ocean surface was the blanket of sort of like an economic structure such as capitalism, to me. And so in terms of doing this work now and the idea of reversing it to a literal sort of sea of sand with its sort of like desert-like connotations and the idea of sort of like that shift in terms of the power, I suppose, from sort of like an economic structure to an ideological sort of structure that is far more sort of like present within our minds now than it was sort of 7 years ago. I suppose that was what I meant.
Okay.
Although you just said that 9/11 was not a very issue of your work and terrorism, I, visiting the piece on Saturday, had very much the impression of a labyrinthic experience. And it reminded me of works I have seen this year in Switzerland and Germany called Weiße Folter from Gregor Schneider and Christoph Büschel's installations at the Art Museum in Basel and at the Art Basel, which both very literally related to the experience of Guantanamo or desert camps in Iraq. However, the access was restricted to only like one people with Gregor Schneider's work or three or four people with Christoph Büschel's work. And I wonder how your work is related to those, because according to my opinion, they have very much in common.
Yeah, well, obviously the work I made in Venice in 2001 was the year. I mean, I made a big labyrinthine work then at the same time as Gregor Schneider was in the German pavilion. So there was always a comparison made between the two. I mean, Gregor Schneider's work, you know, it's very much his own, whatever he... I mean, it's very much bound up with the house in which he works in sort of in Germany. And at the time, for me, it always seemed to me that sort of the house was the real work for Gregor Schneider. And when they took it out from the house, it became almost like a fictionalization of reality, whereas ultimately what I was trying to do was try to make reality out of certain fictional structures. Christoph Büchel is a more, you know, recent artist. I've only ever seen one work by him, which was in Art Basel, the one you mentioned. And the reference is to sort of like, you know, the Gulf War and Islamic culture. I've been making work very much about the Middle East for a long time, but now I don't. I try to avoid it slightly. I mean, my MA show in 1992 was a work called A Staging of the Reconstruction of the Southern Palace of Babylon, which was a sort of like a foundation course or mock ruin of a section of the Southern Palace, which was being rebuilt by Saddam Hussein, with a concrete mixer in the middle with an Arabic logo called the Joke and three stars of the sort of Iraqi flag. And even before that, in 1989, I was working with that Arabic stuff, but more through a personal obsession or an interest with the antithesis of Western culture somehow within Islam, and the intoxication somehow of that culture, which I find incredibly intoxicating, and can see why sort of like people within that country and certainly sort of like second or third generation sort of like Muslims in the first world would become incredibly intoxicated, almost sort of legitimate sort of like exotification of their own sort of culture, which they don't really exist within anymore, sort of. So, but ultimately at the moment, I think unless you've got something really incredibly pertinent to say about kind of Islam, sort of like, or the situation between Islamic peoples and sort of and the West, you have to be very careful in terms of what you utilize in terms of their symbolism and sort of like and that sort of territory in such a way that I think one can be sort of like opportunistic in annexing sort of like a certain power or fear that sort of like comes along with that situation ultimately in such a way which makes the work quite unpalatable.
I got a question over here. Okay.
Hi, I was wondering what happens when a piece is finished? Do you then take it down and everything goes into storage, or do some of the objects then migrate with you to future projects?
No, they all stay as a given piece.
So you're not traveling around the globe?
They used to. In the 90s, I used to, but I was really skint. So, it was like what you could afford. So often you sort of like would find elements coming back into sort of like other works, but not since about 7 or 8 years ago. Sort of the work stayed pretty much sort of like. Each body of work sticks together in a sense, and it just depends on different circumstances. I did a big piece in Melbourne recently, and except for a small crate of stuff, I just demolished a lot, and threw it all away after 3 months of work.
We're going to have a yard sale.
Then
should we take one more question? Does that seem all right? Okay. Okay, why don't you maybe just yell it out? I can't get you.
Can you tell me about the process?
I don't know, really. It's a real mixture, sort of like a bad day in a salvage yard is the worst day out, but sort of a good day is excellent. And then the last night, or the last couple of days where things actually start to be articulated and sort of and make sense, that's very satisfying. I mean, there's a moment when the work kind of turns a certain corner for me, ultimately, or normally. I mean, where you kind of see that it's going to work, or you think it's going to work, where things start to just, in a sort of instinctive sort of way, just drop into place that you've been thinking about. You're kind of thinking, that room's going to go that way. You're not going to commit yourself at this point. You're not going to tell anybody, but you're thinking, I'm going to push that room to that. And then, within a sort of like a half an hour sort of like envelope of time or something, you do that thing in that room, and it's sort of like, okay, that's brought up to speed to a degree, that's working. And those moments, I suppose, are the most satisfying.
Can we take one more?
Okay.
Right in front of you there.
Sure.
You were talking about Ground 11 and Ground Zero and how evocative your work is of this area, but it's also very much evocative not only of an area of temporary absence like Ground Zero is, but also of memorial sites that were preserved, like bones in Rwanda that are piled and are not removed in order to serve as a memorial, or concentration camps that still display certain personal personal objects of prisoners who died there. And how can you say something about the way in which your work relates to this kind of...
To the idea of a memorial.
I'm sorry?
To the idea of a memorial.
To the idea of leaving an area of disaster untouched in order for it to serve as a memorial.
I wouldn't say it's an area of disaster, though, what I've built.
No, not at all. But it is. It does remind it in some way, since...
Yeah, of such sites as that, sort of whether it has a relevance to it, kind of a... ultimately, I suppose, the relevance is that sort of a... I suppose these things, these objects, this space becomes like a kind of votive. It becomes very... if it works, it becomes kind of charged.